Let me recall over here the theorem that I want to prove. And I will right away go into the scaled coordinates. So we can assume that U is a wave map defined on the time interval 0, 1 cross R2 with values on the target surface N. Up at the origin, and in the case when U is radial, then we'll assume that the target manifold is the sphere, or when U is equivariant, a co-rotational map, then we will assume that the function G, when integrated, gives the value infinity. So last time I think I said somewhat incorrectly that this theorem 4 applies in completely general framework, but in fact, in the radially symmetric case, this blow-up result, theorem 4 that I stated, only works when N is the sphere. However, in the co-rotational case, the theorem is valid under this assumption. It's valid under this assumption, which in particular includes the strongly non-compact case when I can just drop the absolute value here, but it will also include the case when the surface is compact. For instance, when the target manifold is the sphere, then G of rho is sine of rho, and in general it's a periodic function of the value rho. So when you take absolute value and integrate from 0 to infinity, you're integrating over infinitely many of these periods. And therefore, for a compact target, this will always give the value infinity. So, last time I forgot to state these two assumptions. So, then, there exist times Ti converging to zero, and radii Ri also converging to zero as I tends to infinity, such that the rescaled maps Ui of T and X given by U of Ti plus Rit Rix, these converge strongly locally to a limit U infinity. In H1, on the time interval minus 1, 1 cross R2 with values into N, where U infinity is a time-independent solution of the wave map system, That is a harmonic map on R2. So in particular, it is also smooth by Frédéric Elin's result. And it is non-constant with finite energy. All right, and we had made a number of preliminary remarks. So first of all, we had seen that basically the picture looks like this. If here I have t equals 0 and here I have t equals 1, and this is the x is x equals 0, then on the forward light cone, the energy concentrates near the x is x equals 0. This is basically where the energy lives. And we had made a choice of radii. For sufficiently small epsilon 1, and times between 1 and 0, we had chosen numbers r equal r of t such that the energy on the ball of radius r, actually I had taken 6 times r of t, is at least equal to epsilon 1, and it is not more than 2 epsilon 1. And we had made the observation that 6 r of t is at most equal to t, and in fact, r of t divided by t goes to 0 as t goes to 0. All right, so that was the what we had achieved last time. And now let's also note the following, that by the energy inequality, we have the following estimates from above and below. If I vary the time step by a number tau, then by the energy inequality, I can estimate this from above by E of U of T, R of T plus tau, and then this will be less than 2 epsilon 1 for all tau less than or equal 5 R. I think this is now number 10. And likewise, we have a lower bound epsilon 1 less than or equal E of U T plus tau on the ball of radius 11 R. This is all the consequence of the energy inequality. So that means that when we fix the time t here and we look at this interval of size 5r in forward time or backward time, around T, then on any such slice here, we can uniformly control the energy from above and below in this shrinking funnel. All right, so let's define lambda of T to be the interval from minus R of T minus R of T to T plus R of T, and let's let lambda star be the interval with a fivefold diameter and then because of this observation here we can be sure that the interval lambda star does not reach down to the tip to the origin in our space-time. This will be the interval lambda star of T, and it will definitely not reach down to T equals zero, because this is at least going to be R of T. So then the intervals lambda T between 0 and 1 will be an open cover of the whole time interval from 0 to 1. An uncountable open cover. And, well, you all know the statement of the Vitali covering lemma. When you have such a covering by balls, and these lambda t are just one-dimensional balls, when you have such a cover by open balls, then you can extract a countable subset so, countably many t's, which I call ti, such that the five-fold enlarged intervals cover, and such that the original lambda ti will be disjoint. So there's a disjoint family of intervals lambda of Ti such that the five-fold enlarged intervals will cover. And this is going to generate our sequence Ui, because now well, first I need also to say that we may assume by rearranging the TI if necessary that the TI are actually monotonically decreasing. All right, so what we want to do is we want to rescale the map U on these time intervals lambda I with radius R of Ti. However, not all these intervals may be good for our purposes. We first have to make a further selection. And that's the following lemma. will show that the lim-inf, as I tends to infinity, of 1 over Ri, where Ri is equal R of Ti, one over R I integral over lambda I of the L2 norm of the time derivative squared. This is zero. And the sequence ui appearing here, of course, will correspond to a selection of i's tending to infinity where this actually goes to zero. So why is this true? This is a very standard argument in the theory of, in the partial regularity theory for elliptic systems or parabolic equations. Such estimates have been used and have been derived from such Vitali-type covering statements for a long while. But I think it's the first time such estimates have been applied in wave equation context, or maybe the first time. I'm not sure. Actually, maybe Yuxi Chen used something like that in a paper on partial regularity for semilinear wave equations. I'm not sure. But at least here, a technique that is very well known in elliptic regularity theory appears in the hyperbolic context. So how does one derive this? Suppose not. Suppose this is not true. So then we suppose there is a delta positive such that this quantity is larger than or equal to delta for sufficiently large I. Then we know that the infimum of the set obtained by taking the union of all the intervals lambda I star from I equal 1 to I naught, this infimum is positive because we can use this estimate for each of the lambda I star. This is actually equal, or it is at least as large as the minimum for I between I1 and I naught of the Ri. So this is positive. And then we can choose some number capital T which is less than this number and still positive. And then, next, we let I1 larger I0 be maximal. Such that the interval from 0 up to t is covered by the union of all lambda I star with I larger than or equal to I1. This I1 will certainly be larger than or equal to I0, because we don't need any of the lambda I star with I less than or equal to I naught to cover this interval. So this this inequality comes for free. And so we make this choice for I1. And then it turns out that this union of lambda I star is actually contained in the interval 0, 11, t. So there is some game involved, again using this inequality and so on, a very simple algebraic game to show that this union here is covered by the interval from 0 up to 11 t. So this second inclusion is implied by the first and the choice of I1. And then, what do we have? Then we can estimate t as follows. This interval is covered by these guys, so the sum of the diameters is larger than t. And the diameter of lambda I star is 10 RI. Now the RI, I hope I did not. Oh, here it is. So the RI can be estimated from here. So this quantity appears on this line too. We multiply by RI and divide by delta. Then we can estimate RI from above by this sum and now the intervals lambda I are disjoint, so this can be estimated by the interval over the union of the same thing. And finally, the lambda I are contained in the lambda I star, and this is contained in the interval from 0 up to 11 t. So we arrive at this. But now, when you divide by t, you conclude that the average of this over smaller and smaller cones is bounded uniformly away from zero. But this is a contradiction to the decay estimate that we had proved before. So this contradicts the decay estimate 7, namely that the average 1 over t times the integral over 0 up to t of this guy goes to 0 as t decays to 0. So this contradicts 7 for small enough t. Therefore, the lemma is true, and then we can rescale as follows. So we take that some sequence where the lim-inf actually is realized, is achieved. And then we rescale around the point Ti 0 with scale parameter Ri. And these maps then are again wave maps. The wave map equation was invariant under scaling space and time coordinates with the same scale parameter R. So these are wave maps. And the symmetry is preserved because we're scaling around the axis x equals 0. And we have uniform energy estimates on larger and larger balls. So when you do the scaling right, this energy here is just the energy of the original map U at the time Ti plus Ri times T. And we also have to scale the radius with Ri, so it's Ti plus Rit. So now the time where we are evaluating the map and the radius on which we're computing the energy are equal. And by the energy inequality, this is uniformly bounded by the energy of the map at time t equal 1 on the unit ball. So this is a uniform bound for the energies of all these maps, uniformly for all times, say t bounded between minus 1 and 1. And moreover, the integral over the time derivative on the ball of radius Ti divided by Ri plus T around 0 . This integral transforms into that integral, so it converges to 0 as I goes to infinity. So the UI are not really wave maps, but they are perturbed harmonic maps where you can regard the time derivative as the perturbation term. And then we may assume that the UI converge weakly in H1 log where U infinity is a time-independent map. And by symmetry, moreover, we also have uniform convergence away from the axis x equals 0, because for symmetric maps, H1 embeds into C0 away from the origin. All right, so what do we need to show now? We need to show that U infinity actually is a harmonic map. We need to show that U infinity is a harmonic map, and this convergence is not only weak but is strong in the H1 norm. And let's first do this in the equivariant case. And remember that in this case, we had very good control over the distance from the center of symmetry. So this was the number g of rho corresponding to a distance rho here. And this function rho then essentially is the function describing our map. And we could estimate the distance rho from the center of symmetry in terms of the energy. And since now, well, I've erased the energy normalization, but since now we have that the soup in time of the energy on the radius 1 is bounded by 2 epsilon 1. Now we can control the supremum of our maps. On the unit ball, uniformly for all t between minus 1 and 1, we can control this by the energy. Actually, there is a monotone function, constant of this, and this decreases to 0 as epsilon 1 goes to 0. So we can make this supremum arbitrarily small. And that's actually all we need to show H1 convergence. So now we multiply the wave map system 1, which is wave of UI equal A of UI, the alpha UI, the upper alpha UI, by UI minus U infinity times phi squared, where phi is any cutoff function with support in minus 1, 1 cross R2. So this would, again, this would be the same testing function that you would use to show H1 convergence in the elliptic case, when this was not the wave operator but the Laplace operator. And in this sense, again, we may interpret this condition as saying that this is really a perturbed harmonic map equation. So when we multiply this, the left-hand side, which is the integral over R3 of box of UI times this guy, the left-hand side after integration by parts is the following. So we have d alpha ui, and then we would have a d upper alpha ui minus u infinity phi squared. Dx dt. Now we know that this converges to zero weakly. So we may throw in u infinity here, because with this fixed function, the alpha acting on u infinity, weak convergence to zero is enough to give us an error term that decays to zero as I tends to infinity. Moreover, because we know that the time derivative decays to zero, we may move this index from the top position to the lower position. Because the error term that involves is just the time derivative of ui squared, and that goes to zero. So this contributes just another term, little o of 1. And then finally, we can remove this parenthesis here and close it there, because the derivative acting on phi will give a term where ui minus u infinity comes up with no derivative. And by Rayleigh's theorem, we may assume that this converges to zero in L2 strongly. And then strong times weak convergence again gives the error term little o of 1. So this guy is, in fact, d of ui minus u infinity localized with our cutoff function phi plus an error little o of 1. And all these integrals are over R3. So the left-hand side converges to what we want to estimate. Remember, we want to show that this convergence is actually strong and not weak. So we need to estimate the difference in the gradients. Gradient ui minus u infinity in L2. Now the right-hand side Now, the right-hand side is not much more difficult. So, we have the A of ui times the d alpha ui, the upper alpha ui, and we multiply by ui minus u infinity phi squared and integrate. Now, these A are bounded coefficients, and this is a bilinear form. And when I throw in the derivative of u infinity here, just as before, I get a term which is of the order d alpha u infinity times something which is weakly converging to zero. And when I actually throw in two of these terms, I also get d alpha u infinity squared times something which is converging pointwise to zero and is uniformly bounded. So we have the hypothesis of Lebesgue's dominated convergence theorem satisfied. So I can throw in u infinity and this thing will give just an error term little o of 1. And then I simply estimate the A by a constant, these guys by this, the norm of the space-time derivatives, and since there's two of these terms, I get this, and I estimate this by the sup of ui minus u infinity times phi squared. But this now can be made arbitrarily small on the unit ball, and for x larger than 1, the modulus of ui minus u infinity converges to 0 uniformly by local uniform convergence. So this can be made as small as we please. Can be made as small as we please, and then this term can be absorbed against this one. So that shows the strong convergence. in the equivariant case. And now I have just 7 minutes to explain what happens in the radially symmetric case when the target manifold is the sphere. This one. This is something that I explained on Friday. This goes back to the work of Jalal Shattar and Tavildat Zadeh for the equivariant problem. They show that this function rho of T and R actually can be bounded. G of rho of T and R can be bounded by the energy of the map U at time t on the ball of radius r. And now, if we take r less than or equal to 1, then we may put in here 1. And this is what I wrote as u of t, 1. And now this is less than 2 epsilon 1. And because of the assumption on the target manifold, the function capital G is proper. So when this number here goes to 0, we conclude that also rho has to go to 0, and rho is essentially the norm of UI. All right, so in the radial case, the story is a little bit more complicated, and the argument only works when the target manifold is the sphere. So we use Elin's trick. We write the wave map equation for the UI, and I denote the components by J. So UI is UI1 through UIN. This is UIJ times the alpha UIK, the upper alpha UIK. And then, so far I have not changed anything, but I can also write this as UIJ, the lower alpha UIK, minus UIK, the lower alpha UIJ, times the upper alpha UIK. The reason being that the product of these two terms here gives zero. And now, let's call this phi I JK. And it turns out that this function phi I JK, alpha, this is the component of a one form which is almost closed. When you take the alpha of this guy, the upper alpha of this guy, you get zero. But also when you take the lower alpha of this guy, you get something involving only the time derivative of UI, and therefore the phi, capital phi, will almost be a closed one form also in the elliptic, with the elliptic background metric. So this is now an idea that follows the work I did with Frere and Stefan Müller. I think in 96. We choose a testing function and it suffices So no laws of generality. It suffices to assume that the support of phi is in the unit cube. And we regard the unit cube in R3 as a fundamental domain for the three torus. And here we put now the Euclidean metric, not the Minkowski metric, as a background metric, and then we decompose the one form phi in a gradient part, dAijk, plus the Euclidean codifferential of a two-form bijk plus a harmonic part. Well, I don't have the time to discuss all these terms, I have to multiply this by a cutoff function. That's right. Thanks very much. So now, after I multiply by this cutoff function and extend periodically, I can view this as a one form on the Euclidean three torus, which I then decompose into these three terms. And now, the left-hand side, well, observe that u infinity equals zero, or a constant. So I can drop u infinity and I multiply by ui times phi squared. And again, the left-hand side gives me what I want. It gives me dui squared, du infinity is zero. So it's dui minus u infinity squared times phi squared plus a small error. And the right-hand side is a sum of three terms. It's this term plus this term plus this term. Now, we know that the phi I converges to zero weakly, because everything here converges to zero weakly, and therefore the harmonic components converge to zero strongly. These are actually smooth functions on R3, converge to zero strongly. I don't need to worry about those. And then for the aijk, I can use that the time derivative decays, and these terms here will converge to zero in L2. That's by convergence of the time derivative. So also these guys here converge to zero. And therefore what's left is the delta bijk times the duijk uik phi squared. Or maybe there is a... So that index was too much. And now, as was demonstrated, I think for the first time by Craig Evans, for the corresponding elliptic problem, such terms here, they have a very useful structure. Actually, the results of Kaufmann, Lyons, Meyer, Sim may be applied, and it turns out that this here is an element of the Hardy space H1, and this here is an element of the space of John Nirenberg, BMO, bounded mean oscillation, and this is the dual space of that. And from this duality, then, you can estimate the first term You can estimate the first term by the H1 norm of this guy times the BMO norm of that, and that gives you dui squared phi squared to a power 3 over 2. This is bounded by this integral to the power 1/2, the Dirichlet integral. But here we have another power, and here we have a third power, so it's 3 over 2 times the power of this guy, plus little o of 1. And if you make the epsilon 1 small enough, then the Dirichlet integral dominates, and you can show convergence. Sorry for taking 3 more minutes. Thank you very much for your attention.